As billions turn their eyes to the World Cup in Brazil, it's worth mentioning that American soccer, once considered an embarrassing backwater, has grown over the last two decades into a multi-million dollar business that is flexing its athletic and economic muscle on the world stage. One man, Chuck Blazer, has been largely responsible for shaping American soccer, and along the way he has also received a rather large share of the profits using what a former employer claims are some very questionable business practices, including misappropriation of funds, evasion of U.S. tax laws, and even outright fraud. Ken Benzinger, a staff writer at BuzzFeed, has written an article about Chuck Blazer called Mr. 10%, and you can find a link to it on our show page at WNYC.org. I'm pleased to welcome Ken Benzinger to our program. Hello.
Hi, thanks for having me.
I have to confess that I don't follow the sport all that closely. Is Chuck Blazer very well known within the world of professional soccer?
I'd say that among soccer aficionados, he's well known, but that would be the people who are very serious about it. Your typical lay fan, people who follow a few games, maybe even follow a few teams, probably haven't heard of him. In fact, that's really what appealed to me about him as a character, is that he was enormously, enormously powerful and yet almost unknown outside of the 1% of soccer fans who follow at the administrative level.
Despite the fact that he's really easy to spot, he kind of looks like Santa Claus.
That's right. He looks a lot like Santa Claus. In fact, he, on a number of occasions, has dressed up as Santa Claus. And to give your listeners a sense, he's a very big man with a big belly, has a giant, full, white, curly beard and a big head, has curly white hair and bushy white eyebrows. I mean, you really couldn't imagine a more Santa Claus-looking person. He was aware of that and loved to play it up.
Has he been respected throughout most of his career?
I think so, and at times he's been celebrated. There was a short period of time, for example, in 2011, where he was being held up as a champion of transparency, truth, justice, and all things good in soccer. Unfortunately, that ended rather quickly, and he became looked at as another problem in the world of soccer and its corruption issues. Go ahead.
In many parts of the world, isn't soccer considered corrupt? We recently learned of a match-fixing scandal last World Cup, but it was perceived differently in this country until, as you say, just recently. Why have Americans bought the squeaky clean image until recently?
I think the history of soccer in America is unique because it's always been sort of, you know, an afterthought of a sport compared to our big baseball, football, basketball, and to a lesser degree, hockey sports. We just, Americans haven't thought of it in the same way. And as a result, it's been the sport that kids play in the suburbs, and it was the sport of innocence and clean, good, wholesome fun. In the rest of the world, it is the main sport. I mean, in Europe, South America, throughout Latin America, most of Africa, soccer is what people play. And people anywhere you go in the rest of the world are acutely aware of how corrupt and dirty a sport it is. And we sort of are an island of innocence when it comes to soccer.
Because our scandals have been in baseball, basketball, and football.
Correct. But I think that the Chuck Blazer story tells us that, in fact, that it's just as corrupt, or the potential for corruption is just as large here. And it's only because no one perhaps was minding the fort that this thing escaped public notice for so long.
Do we know how much money Mr. Blazer has made from professional soccer over the course of his career?
Well, let's put it this way. We have a low estimate, and the low estimate is $22 million. And I call it a low estimate because we only know what he made from one organization where he did most of his activities. So the sense is that's probably the largest share of it. But he also worked with FIFA, which is the largest organization and most important organization in soccer, and there has been no accounting of how much money he made there. It's a complete black box. But the other organization is called CONCACAF, which is an acronym, and it's the organization that oversees all international soccer from Panama up through Canada, so including the U.S., Mexico, and the Caribbean. All are overseen by this organization, and he essentially ran that organization for more than 20 years.
The Confederation of North Central American and Caribbean Association Football, CONCACAF. He has a contract that entitles him to 10% of just about everything that CONCACAF earns. He declined to speak with you for this article, but how did people that you interviewed describe his personality and his disposition?
Yeah, that's right. I spoke to him twice on the phone, but he didn't really want to discuss the article, and in fact has been having some health problems and deferred talking because of the health issue. I spoke to a lot of people about him, and people sort of universally talk about his gregariousness and his friendliness and his showmanship and his salesmanship and the fact that he's a great conversationalist and very clever. He's a person who loves new technology and is always thinking about what's next. He's really a great businessman is what he is, and a salesman. And I think that played very much to his advantage because he got into a sport that was about to grow quickly at the right time, and what would easily be taken sort of control of by someone who had those abilities. He was the right man for the right moment. People describe him on negative terms as someone who is controlling and someone who doesn't like to share information and someone who can be a bit vengeful when crossed. And I think the package of attributes makes someone who was uniquely and ideally suited to take control of CONCACAF, which he did in 1990, make it essentially his own and steer it in the direction he wanted. And the contract you mentioned is really key because it's really a unique and incredible document. And those who take the time, read the article, can click through to a separate document we have, which lists all kinds of other documents and has an actual copy of that contract. And it's really worth looking at. It's an amazing document. And I showed it to some lawyers, and their eyes popped out of their heads. It was written by him and the other person who came to power in CONCACAF, and it entitled him, as you said, to 10% of everything. And in fact, it even gave him 10% on top of the 10%, and it gave him all sorts of other perks, down to a life insurance policy that would benefit his family that was paid for by soccer. And it's just remarkable. What it created was an incentive for Blazer to grow soccer because he would get a cut of all the increased revenue that CONCACAF got.
And that includes ticket sales, luxury box rentals, parking fees, even hot dog sales.
That's right, the whole kit and caboodle. And in fact, over time, he decided to interpret the contract to include things that clearly weren't allowed in the contract. And one of the examples is that FIFA, which is the World Soccer Organization, gave CONCACAF $3 million for the purpose of building a television studio in the CONCACAF offices in New York City. And that clearly was money that was not fitting under what the 10% was supposed to apply to. But records later showed that Blazer didn't care. He took 10%, $300,000 from that deal for himself. There was almost no money that came into CONCACAF that he didn't take his 10% on. And in addition, he got CONCACAF to pay for all sorts of things that he enjoyed only for himself that yet didn't come out of his compensation. So we can think of those as extra benefits. An example would be that the organization bought an SUV, a Hummer, for him to drive. It bought an apartment in Miami that only he used but belonged to CONCACAF, and it was an $800,000 apartment that only he used. It paid insurance for him. It paid housekeeping for his private apartment. It paid a big chunk of his private rent and his apartment. The list goes on and on and on. I think they spent almost $260,000 on his personal living expenses in 2011.
And most of the money was paid to offshore shell companies.
That's right. Blazer, before he was in soccer, was in sales of marketing promotional items, what people in the industry call premiums. These are the sort of giveaways you might get at the supermarket or things they mail you in the mail, these sort of trinkets. And he sold those. And in that industry, he started using shell companies, or otherwise known as DBAs. And he would do that as a way to keep his name out of transactions. He almost never got paid directly. He almost always got paid through his companies. And his company started out based in New York. But over time, he started basing his companies in the Cayman Islands, the Bahamas, and elsewhere. And makes it incredibly hard to figure out how much he got paid, when, and particularly whether he ever paid any income tax on this stuff, which is one of the issues that has come forward, is whether this guy essentially has been cheating the IRS for many years.
He was one of the manufacturers of those smiley face buttons that said, "Have a happy day." You quote one of the people who worked with him on the buttons as saying, "Chuck was a charming guy, but everybody is nice until they screw you."
Yeah, that was Bernie Spain. And the Spain brothers are a fascinating pair of guys who live in Philadelphia. They're getting on in years, but they have a great story themselves. They popularized the smiley face button in around 1970. They didn't invent it, but they got it to be huge, and people will recall it was a period of time in the early 70s when those things were everywhere. And they used Chuck Blazer as one of their primary manufacturers of the buttons. And Blazer supplied them tens of millions of buttons, and they had a great relationship. But they ended it because they found out that Blazer, despite what they thought was an exclusive relationship, was secretly selling buttons out the back door to other people, and so they cut off the relationship. The Spain brothers went on to create the Dollar General stores, I believe, and they sold that for $500 million a few years ago and did very well. But they still have strong memories of the relationship with Blazer, who at the time was had a button factory in Queens, and they would drive out there and pick up his shipments.
When did Blazer get interested in soccer?
So Blazer, he grew up in Queens. He grew up in Rego Park and went to Forest Hills High School. And later, after college, moved to Westchester, bought a house in Scarsdale and moved there and had kids. And when his son was old enough to play soccer, got him involved in youth soccer in Westchester County, I believe in New Rochelle. And he quickly became a coach. And at the time, there was just not a lot going on. But it was just starting. It was really the moment when soccer was just starting to blow up as something that young kids were doing. And he got involved in coaching and then administration. And because there was so little people involved, he very quickly jumped up in the ranks.
And he got Pelé to campaign for him when he got involved with the United States Soccer Federation. But he seems to be pretty much on the up and up at that time, or at least a positive force. Wasn't he instrumental in getting the United States into the 1990 World Cup?
I mean, I think he played an important role in that. He was elected to the United States Soccer Federation in 1984, and that's an interesting story in of itself. The U.S. Soccer Federation is now a very well organization, very respected and very professionalized. But at the time, it was running on a shoestring. It rented space in the Empire State Building, which might sound prestigious, but at the time was kind of a janky old office building that had problems. And he ran for it, and on the force of running youth soccer, essentially got elected, as you mentioned, through a brilliant marketing move of getting Pelé to campaign for him. And he was the number two guy at the U.S. Soccer Federation. His job was to promote international soccer. Well, in the two previous years, the U.S. men's national team had played, I think, exactly one or two games in the previous 2 years. I mean, it just wasn't an active program. And he turbocharged the program and got them to play, I think, 19 or 20 matches in the 2 years he was at the Soccer Federation. And they failed to qualify for the 1986 World Cup, which was in Mexico City. But under him, they made their mission to qualify for the 1990. He was voted out in 1986, but by then he'd already set the team in motion, and they indeed did qualify in 1989 for the 1990 World Cup in Italy. And that was a watershed moment because the U.S. national team hadn't qualified for a World Cup since 1950, which incidentally was the last time that the World Cup was played in Brazil. So a lot of people believe that he's the one who sort of pushed that thing in motion and got it going. And it should be noted that under him, the U.S. women's national team was inaugurated. There was no team prior to Blazer's time at the Soccer Federation, and they played their first game when he was in charge of international competitions.
My guess is Ken Bensinger, staff writer at BuzzFeed, has written an article about Chuck Blazer called Mr. 10%. We have a link to it on our show page at WNYC.org. He also co-founded the American Soccer League. Were there questions about the finances of that league and how Blazer compensated himself there?
Yeah, great question. The American Soccer League came up. He founded it shortly after getting booted off the U.S. Soccer Federation administration. He founded it, and it was at a time when people were trying all kinds of different professional leagues because there wasn't a dominant or even really a successful league at that point. And it was felt that the country needed a professional league to be a serious soccer country and to get the 1994 World Cup, which we ultimately did get, and had to host it. But FIFA was saying that they wanted to see professional leagues here if they were going to do that. And so he founded this league quickly demonstrated a pattern which he would later show at CONCACAF and had shown elsewhere, which was to take control of everything and sort of do it all behind closed doors. I discovered in researching this article that he began paying himself what was a very high salary compared to what the league's finances were. That league was operating on the idea that it would be very low budget and have salary caps of $50,000 per team, meaning the combined salary of all the players on the team would be $50,000 or less. Well, he personally was paying himself $65,000 as the commissioner of the league. Now, this was 87, 88 time period. That's not millionaire money, but in relative to what the league was running on, it was a crazy amount of money. And the other owners in the league, the owners in the league quickly tired of how he was spending money and pushed him out. But he immediately landed on his feet as the president of one of the clubs in the league and immediately raised his personal salary to $72,000 and had all kinds of perks. They paid for his housing. They paid for his travel. The list goes on and on.
And then he was fired by the Sharks as well, the Miami Sharks. So considering his checkered career, how did he gain control of CONCACAF, and why were they willing to give him this incredibly generous contract? Is it because they weren't making any money at the time and didn't think that it would be worth very much?
I think the answer to the second part of your question is because there was essentially no oversight. CONCACAF was a tiny organization, kind of on the order of U.S. Soccer Federation when Blazer first came in, poorly organized, and had really no revenue sources. And his brilliant vision was that if you counted the votes, it was a very sort of almost a democratic vision. If you counted the votes of all the member states, you realize that the Caribbean nations far outnumber all the others. And even though Caribbean soccer is not at the level of Mexico, for example, there's so many of them. If you could get them all to vote as a bloc, you could elect whatever candidate you wanted. And so Blazer teamed up with a guy from Trinidad named Jack Warner, who is a very familiar name in soccer circles because he became extremely powerful in FIFA and potentially even more corrupt than Chuck Blazer. Blazer approached Warner and said, I think that if you can muster all the Caribbean votes, you can have this organization. And it was Blazer's idea, and Blazer pushed Warner, and Warner agreed, and they worked together, and they got all these countries like Barbados and Anguilla and St. Kitts to vote in favor of Jack Warner for president. And Warner won the presidency in 1990 and immediately appointed Chuck Blazer as his general secretary. So Blazer's job, unlike Warner's, was not elected and never was. He was always appointed. And Warner essentially busied himself with Trinidad and Caribbean affairs and did not pay attention to Mexico or U.S. very much. Blazer saw that's where the real commercial potential was and made those his own. And as I said earlier about the contract, they wrote that together. No one else signed it. No one else approved it. Over 21 years, the question of Blazer's compensation was brought up three times before CONCACAF's executive committee and the other members. None of them ever really raised much comment. There was very little pushback. And essentially, the picture it paints is that this organization had no oversight and no real governance other than these two people. It's a real fox guarding the hen house kind of situation.
And meanwhile, Blazer keeps on moving up. He's eventually elevated to a job at the Fédération Internationale de Football Association, FIFA, which we people will recognize that name. He got to hobnob with a lot of celebrities. He even spent time palling around with Vladimir Putin, didn't he?
Yeah, it's an amazing anecdote. There's a Chuck Blazer ran a blog, which last check is still up, and it's a remarkable blog, sort of an uncensored look at his world. And he created it as a way to sort of talk about his travels in FIFA. And he traveled around the world, stayed at the nicest hotels, flew first class, and hobnobbed with incredibly powerful, important, famous people. And the Putin example is fantastic because it really demonstrates what that world is like. In 2010, he visited Moscow, and Russia was lobbying to be the host of the 2018 World Cup. And he went to Moscow and was taken to the Kremlin and had a private audience with Putin, who spent a lot of time with him and sort of seemed to hang off Chuck Blazer's every word and told Blazer that he loved his blog and actually asked Blazer if he could post personal travel photos on Blazer's blog. And indeed, that happened. There are now on his blog, on Chuck Blazer's blog, photos that Vladimir Putin sent him to put up. Well, needless to say, Blazer was completely charmed by the whole thing, thought it was wonderful, and a few months later voted for Russia to host the 2018 World Cup. Voted for them over England, by the way, which was a country that had been really counting on Blazer to support it.
Which invented the sport.
That's right. And a lot of English are very bitter at Blazer for doing that. But that was his choice, and it actually sort of transitions to something that Warner did, which was that Warner had promised, but Warner was also on FIFA's board, and he had promised Blazer that he would vote for the U.S. to host the 2022 World Cup. And That vote was held on the same day as the Russia, the 2018 vote, and it turns out that potentially Warner voted for Qatar instead of the U.S. And this was a heartbreaking moment for Blazer because I think he really wanted the U.S. to host the 22 World Cup, and probably wanted it for both altruistic and personal reasons.
Ben, we have very little time. When did his fall from grace begin, and what is the prospects? Is the U.S. law enforcement looked into all of these charges? Because some of them are obviously quite illegal.
Yeah, so the fall from grace happens because in May 2011, Blazer sort of betrays Warner and reports him to FIFA as helping organize bribes for something, $40,000 bribes given to a bunch of Caribbean football officials, soccer officials. And so he sticks a knife essentially in Warner's back. And this leads to a lot of digging and soul-searching and looking at the affairs of CONCACAF, which inevitably turns the arrow towards Blazer. And later that year, Blazer is pushed out of CONCACAF, and the investigations start, and they start uncovering all kinds of things. And in 2013, Blazer says he's going to not run for the FIFA organization position anymore. And in April 2013, a huge report comes out detailing in great detail a lot of the stuff that Blazer did. Meanwhile, lots of people are having conversations with the FBI and the IRS. And the feeling is that it's quite possible that the shoe is going to drop on that. CONCACAF itself said that they believe he defrauded and cheated the IRS and certainly broke all kinds of rules within FIFA and within CONCACAF, and cost the organization its tax-free status because he never even filed tax returns. So there's a lot of people waiting to see whether Blazer gets into legal trouble as well.
Ken Bensinger is a staff writer at BuzzFeed. His article on Chuck Blazer is called Mr. 10%, and you can find a link to it on our show page at WNYC.org. Ken, thank you so much for talking with us today.
That was my pleasure. Thanks so much for the interest in the story.